Good evening. This presentation is part of the 2003-2004 Alexa Fullerton Hampton Speaker Series entitled Trailblazers. It gives me great pleasure tonight to introduce this evening's speaker. Elaine Brown is an impassioned activist, author, and lecturer. Her latest book, The Condemnation of Little B, explores racism in contemporary American society. In her first book, A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story, Brown tells the compelling story of growing up in the ghettos of North Philadelphia, her schooling in that city, and her leadership in the civil rights movement. Aside from writing and lecturing, Brown is president of the nonprofit educational foundation Fields of Flowers. She's director of political affairs for the National Alliance for Radical Prison Reform, a board member of Mothers Advocating Juvenile Justice, and vice president of the Dr. Huey P. Newton Foundation. Elaine Brown became head of the Black Panther Party in 1974. Today, as an activist, she upholds the original vision of the Black Panthers and the survival programs that they developed, such things as the free breakfast program for children, sickle cell anemia screening, and free health clinics, among others. Please join me in welcoming to Scripps College the trailblazer, Elaine Brown.
Wow. Now what do I say? Thank you very much for coming out, and thank you, President Bakovec. I always felt that a lot of my ability to find myself in a leadership position in the Black Panther Party and ability to assume a leadership position had to do with my experiences at once in the ghettos of North Philadelphia, as well as a young woman growing up in a school called the Philadelphia High School for Girls, which was a school that really taught us leadership as women. But, you know, of late, people would have asked me about this business of having become the leader of the Black Panther Party. You know, men particularly ask me all the time, you know, well, how did you actually become the head of the Black Panther Party? And I had a young guy ask me, and actually it was at Spelman College, which was interesting that a guy would actually stand up in an audience full of black women and ask me a question like this, but which only goes to show you how absurdly stupid this guy, how incredibly stupid, rather, he was. But in any case, he asked me about how I became the chairman of the Black Panther Party and ultimately the leader of the Black Panther Party for a period of time. That he said that the rumor was that I had slept with Eldridge Cleaver and slept with Huey Newton and slept with Bunchy Carter, and that this was how I had become the head of the Black Panther Party. And so he said, what did I have to say to that? And I said, well, the first thing is that I never slept with Bunchy Carter. I thought about it, but we just never got around to it, you know. So. And the second thing is that Eldridge Cleaver slept with half the women in the state of California in and out of the Black Panther Party. And the third thing is that Huey Newton surely slept with the other half, because everybody was in love with Huey Newton at one time or another who ever met him or saw him at the time. And so I noticed that with all of that going on, not one of those women ended up as the chairman and leading member of the Black Panther Party. So one would have to ask the question, what conclusion can one draw from that? Well, either that was not the criterion for leadership in the Black Panther Party, or that I was absolutely one of the best women in the state of California. So the question is, what is this business of what is my role as a woman and what is my role? And for black women, this is a particularly difficult situation, because we are always contending with the notion of, are we black or are we female? You know, if we line up on feminist issues, are we going to become white women or white women? You know, and we have all these questions that we do raise in our minds. And I think one of the ways we can look at it is we can think of it as in terms of, well, if we look at an example, if we look at the present sort of bourgeois feminist notions then we would say that Condoleezza Rice is a success story, you know. And I don't think you can put a gele on Condoleezza Rice and turn her into a sister. So she's been, you know, serving two generations of Bush men and in their capacity. So the question is, what is the role of women, but what is the ideology that we're really talking about here? Are we saying that it's a wonderful thing that we have a Condoleezza Rice or an Oprah Winfrey any more than we're talking about Clarence Thomas or the or Colin Powell, who is sort of Clarence Thomas with a gun? So what is it that we are talking about when we're talking about the role of women? Are we saying we want to be equal with men so that we can be we can make an argument that Shoshana Johnson should have been given equal play with Jessica Lynch, and that she didn't get the movie deal because she wasn't white and blonde? But what about what Shoshana Johnson and Jessica Lynch were doing in Iraq there to kill some other women in the name of oil? And if we don't understand that, then we start imagining that having a gender role and being a woman in leadership is all that we really want to do. And then we'll start embracing Margaret Thatcher as one of our sisters, you know. So that's how we have to be very careful about what is the ideology that underwrites that. And so the question becomes is, what are some of the goals? What was my role in the Black Panther Party? Was it to say that I am now a woman in leadership, or was it to say that the Black Panther Party had something that I was participating in that went to something more than whether or not I was a woman in it? Because then that would mean it would be all right for me to be a general, or to be Condoleezza Rice, or to be any of the other so-called women who have taken over leadership roles and promoting and perpetuating some of the most repressive and oppressive schemes in the world, and participating in that. So I think the real issue I want to focus in on now then is what was my role in the party, not necessarily as a woman, but as a part of the Black Panther Party. And then the question becomes, well, what was the role of the Black Panther Party? What was even the need for it? I've had young blacks today ask me, well, you know, Ms. Brown, you know, back in the day, in your day when there was, you know, segregation, you know, as though we have not resegregated America's schools already, right? As though America's schools is, everything's over now. So he said, well, back in your day, I can understand that, but what about today? What's the problem today? Everything seems okay. We got Oprah Winfrey, you know. We have Michael Jordan, or whatever else it is that we have. What is the problem today? And this is an astounding question coming from a young black, but I know that this question is raised because we've become very fuzzy. And this is why the subtitle of my book is New Age Racism, because it's a way that we look at life and we pretend that, well, there isn't really racism in America. There's just choices that people make. And black people, if they really, really worked hard, I mean, look at the Vietnamese. They come here, they work hard, they make it. Don't we say that stuff all the time? You know, people are sitting in this audience right now figuring out, well, what is the problem? You know, is there something wrong with black people where we can't get together and have businesses? And what about the number of people in prison? You have 2 million people in prison in America today, and half of those people are black. Is there something, do black people have like a criminal gene? Is there some genetic flaw among blacks that there's so many blacks in prison? And people are asking that question. Now, what about the SAT? Why is it that black people can't pass the SAT? You remember the book, The Bell Curve, 1994? It was a bestseller in 1994. And it continues to be discussed as though it actually is an authentic piece of academic work or some type of intelligent activity, written by two Harvard professors, one of whom was dead at the time of publication, neither one of whom had any relationship to behavioral sciences, which is where the question of intelligence is generally studied, And both of them wrote an 800-page tome in which they asserted, first of all, their primary argument was that the SAT was a reflection of the inherent intelligence of human beings. And so some people began to argue with Murray and Herrnstein, the authors of the Bell Curve, and they argued the question as to whether or not why it was that black people were not passing the SAT at the same rate as white people. Because their argument was that these test results were proof, or what this was proof that black people were not only intellectually inferior, but inherently so. And so therefore there's no point in putting any money into educating black people because it could not be educated. And we know this because of the test results of the SAT. This was a phenomenon to me. It's a phenomenon in so many different ways until it's pathetic, but one of the reasons that it's pathetic is because we don't know anything about intelligence. We don't even have a definition for intelligence. You have people running around here still talking about Broca's brain and putting Einstein's brain. Remember, they had Einstein's brain, been studying for years and years. Well, is it bigger, smaller? Should we look at it? Been in a jar all these years, people looking at Einstein's brain and trying to figure out whether or not there was some brain, some genetic thing that was unusual about his brain or so forth and so on that made him a, quote, genius. And so we don't have a real definition for intelligence, for human intelligence. Because I look at it like this. If I see a young black woman, you know, who has a baby or two babies, let's say, and she's getting $300, $400 a month in the state of Georgia where I live, and she figures out how to pay rent and feed her children and get on the bus and do all kinds of other stuff, I figure she's a genius, okay? Because me, I couldn't figure out how to do that. I figure that's a genius to me. But the point is, this whole argument got to be about the inherent intelligence of black people, and everybody bought into it. Black people started saying, well, wait a minute, it's the way the test is phrased. It's certain phrases that black people don't get. It's a middle-class white test language, you know, so forth, so on. And everybody became confused. Well, what is the reason? Is there something wrong with black people? And we ask this question as though it's a very serious question. The SAT is absolutely proof of nothing. It's proof that you are very good at taking the SAT. And that's all. It's kind of like garbage in and garbage out. It doesn't prove any inherent intelligence. Because if I were to give a test to all those of you, for example, in this room who came in the top 1%, if anybody in here did, or 5%, if anybody in here did, I'll bet if I were to give you a test on African-American history, history of black people in America, you would all come in the bottom. If that were the test criterion, then that would be, you would be at the bottom of life. So let's not get excited about what the SAT means. But what it really meant, and what the Marion Herenstein argument really meant, is that the way racism plays itself out in America today is we believe that the condition of black people has something to do with the choices that we make. You know, it's like Nancy Reagan, just say no. You could just say no. You didn't have to use drugs. And why there's so many black people on drugs, so many black people with AIDS, the black infant mortality rate, double that of white infant mortality rate, the black women dying of cervical cancer and breast cancer, double the rate of white women, black men dying of prostate cancer, double the rate of white men. As a matter of fact, black men in America having the highest prostate cancer rate in the world, and people actually trying to talk about, what is the diet question? These are lifestyle questions. And if they would just change your diet and change your lifestyle and really try hard, you can make it in America, because America, everything's free now. It's that the 60s are over. King died for your freedom. Everything is fine. Everything is okay. There's no problem in America anymore, and if there is a problem, it's something wrong with you. And it must be inherent. That's why we have the levels of poverty in America among black people, because there's something wrong with black people. And this really takes a great burden off of the white man. You know, it's because something called the white man's burden during slavery. You know, it was like the slave master had to take care of his slaves, they'd feed them so they could continue to, you know, work. They had to be at least fed. So it was a white man's burden. And so this takes the burden off. People can vote for Giuliani secretly, even though New York City was a predominantly Democratic city. They could vote for Giuliani because they could say, well, I'm really not a racist, but I'm just so happy he's cleaning up New York. And what that really means is I'm just not going to look at all that nasty black riffraff, all those drug users, all those beggars, those prostitutes. I'm just tired of looking at them. And even black people say stuff like this. If they would just try harder, they could make it. You know, it's like, well, you can be president if you really try hard. Anybody can really try hard, and you can be president. All of us can really try hard and be president. Now, what do you figure the odds are for those of us in this room? Probably about as good as they were when they wrote the Constitution. So let's talk about the Constitution for a minute. Because the reason that I want to go into the question of black history is that we have to talk about how did we get here and what does this all mean? Because either we do believe there's something wrong with black people, that's why black children, you know, people, there's this whole notion that black women turn their children on their stomachs to sleep instead of their backs, and that's why we have a high black infant mortality rate. It has nothing to do with health care. It has nothing to do with poverty. It has to do with some lifestyle choice that black women made. And if they would just make the correct lifestyle, there would not be a high black infant mortality rate. And people run around here believing that. Or like this kid, Little B, that I wrote a book about. Here you have a kid who grows up in the ghetto of America. And wait a minute, there are still ghettos in America in 1983 when he was born? In the age of Reagan, age of crack, which is all one same period, interestingly enough. Here's a kid born in the ghetto of Atlanta, Black Mecca. You mean there's a ghetto in a place called Black Mecca? There's also a ghetto. And a kid is born and he grows up. By the time he's 8 years old, his house becomes the crack house. And his mother's on crack. His father's on crack, although you know his father. And people say, oh, yeah, this is a typical black dysfunction story. You know, we know these people. You know, these people not taking care of their children, break down the black family, all that. And by the time he's 10 or 11 years old, the courts have taken his mother to, brought his mother to court so many times on failure to take care of him that finally the juvenile court decides that the mother is unfit, that he is being abused effectively by negligence. And so they remove him from her home, not that they had a home because their home was the crack house. But they remove him, put him in a group home. He runs away and becomes runs away from the group home and comes back to what he knows, which is the bluff, which is the ghetto, and begins to become sell dope because he's afraid if he goes to school, he'll be arrested by the DFACS people because he thinks of himself as having done something wrong in the first place. Well, eventually he gets arrested, and by the time he's 13 years old, he's arrested for a murder that I not only say but know that he did not commit, but in any case, he's convicted of that and sentenced to life in prison. And I want to get back to Little B in a minute on the case itself. But just in general, as I looked at that case, I thought to myself, and I saw his little face, his kid, little 13-year-old kid, 4 feet, 6 inches tall, and I looked at his face on the newspaper, just spread across this bad boy, this super predator. This is what's wrong with the black community. This is what Clinton told us in 1993. You know, Clinton, the black president, that some Toni Morrison and Chris Rock said he was the first black president. I found that interesting because I couldn't figure out what it was that Clinton had done that would put him into the category. Although he did get recently was put into the Arkansas Black Hall of Fame as the first non-black who was in the Arkansas. That's scary, isn't it? It's some scary moments. It was like Bush going down to Atlanta and laying that wreath on King's, and the Negroes were just so happy in Atlanta. Woo, Massa Bush is here. We happy. So when Clinton told us, he said, listen, in 1993, Clinton made a speech in November of 93 in the very pulpit, the last pulpit in Memphis, Tennessee, that Dr. King gave his last speech. And Clinton said, you know, I'm standing here in the shadow of Martin Luther King, and I'm looking at all these wonderful people here, and Bishop somebody, and the barbecue, and he went on to do all this black stuff, you know, and eventually he said, I'm thinking to myself, you know, what would Martin say if he were alive today? And imagine Clinton saying, what would Martin say? But anyway, he was talking about, yes, I mean, if Martin were alive today, what would he say? I died for your freedom, and look what you've done with it. And people were really shocked by that. And what was shocking to me was, I know Martin Luther King was killed, but I was trying to say, wait a minute, we were free? When did this happen? He was killed April the 4th of 1968. I was in Oakland. No, actually, I was in Los Angeles at the time. I know I went to bed that night a slave, and I woke up a slave. I was trying to think, did I sleep through freedom? Because it must have happened in the midnight hour, somewhere between April the 4th and April the 5th. Because from that point forward, I haven't seen freedom for black people. But Clinton said that black people had been free, had freedom, and look what we'd done with it. There had been the breakdown of the black family, black on black crime, and the, of course, dreaded black teen unwed mother. And this was the problem, not America. There's no need for reparations, especially Clinton said. There's no need for reparations, apologies. America's a wonderful place. It's been healed. If anything, we can have dialogue on race. But there's no problem here. If there's a problem here, something wrong with you, black people. And that's what Clinton said, and that's what we like to say in America. That way we can shrug our shoulders like Atlas shrugged, and we can say this is not our problem anymore. These are bad choices that people have made. If they had worked harder, they could have been president, could have been Oprah, could have been Michael Jordan. Who do you think is going to be Michael Jordan other than Michael Jordan? But anyway. So we have to ask ourselves, how did this all happen? And in order to do that, we have to spend a little bit of time actually talking about black history. And I don't speak of black history in terms of those firsts. You ever notice how the whole history becomes a calendar of firsts? You know, the Ebony magazine, somebody got a job, the first black person to get a job. You know what I mean? And still talking about somebody getting a job as though this is like a big deal. You know, it's like, he has a job, you know. It's so unusual, we have to put it on the cover of Ebony magazine. He is the vice president of human resources because he's always the vice president of human resources of some benign or irrelevant corporation and so forth and so on. And we're going to celebrate the job. We don't own anything, but we're working somewhere. And that's all we really want. You know, the way Gershwin said, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. So let's talk about a little bit about how we came to be in this situation, because either, as I should start to say, the little bees of the world and all of us who are black and poor in America are this way because of some bad lifestyle choices, or there's something wrong with the scheme of things. You know, when I look at the little bee case, before I get back to this history, a history lesson that I'm going to try to give in 5 minutes, when I look at the situation of Little B, and I remember how he was cast as this terrible kid, you know, with all this super predator, and he was a thug, and he killed a man for nothing in front of his kids, and everybody thought that he was a, they said, you know, we had a wonderful city. Black people had beautiful, we had sweet Auburn. It was kids like this that messed it up. You know, people have really rewrite history, don't they? Auburn Avenue was never a great place. You know, black people say, we had beautiful neighborhoods one time. Where were these neighborhoods? They had a barbecue joint, you know what I'm saying, and a barber shop, and a shoe, and a dress shop, and called that having a great neighborhood. But these kids, not the whole scheme of things, but these few little kids ruined these golden paved streets. So Little B is cast as this super predator, and people are studying whether or not there's actually a genetic relationship between crime, the relationship between crime and genetics. You know, this question never came up. You remember Kip Kinkle? In Oregon, well, he was one of those kids in that little wave of people that were killing all their friends, you know. Well, Kip was a little white kid in Oregon who killed mom and dad one morning, just got up and just killed both of them, and then went off to school with, you know, a number of guns and shot up 25 of his best friends. And the school was, everybody was crying. You know that scene, because you've seen it. Everybody was just crying, oh, my God, oh, my God. And they put a banner up, and the banner said, why, Kip? What was wrong with Kip? Was he feeling bad that day? Was he alienated? Was he looking at too many violent videos? What's wrong with our youth? We've got to look at this. Of course Kip was upset. He has killed his mother and father. Kip was mad. Must have been something very bad going on in the household because Kip has killed both of these people. And plus, he put a bomb in the house, so if you found their bodies as he stuffed them up underneath the house was going to blow. And then when he was arrested, even after he was taken down, he had a knife, and he was 13, 14 years old, knife taped to his chest and drew his knife on the sheriff. And people said, what was wrong with Kip? It's like the Columbine boys. We've got to look into this alienation question. What's if their clothing? They were really good guys. And what happened to them? And we started saying, but we didn't say that about Little B. We didn't say what happened to Little B that day. He only killed one person. He's only charged with killing one person, not 25. But we don't say, is he looking at too many videos? Too much BET? What's the problem with Little B? We don't ask those questions. We know what the problem is. He's a super predator. He's a criminal, you see. We know what that problem is, even though it's an absurd question, because we know that, in fact, crime is not a moral question, much less a biological question. It is, in fact, a social and political question. Why do we know that? Because we know when we go into Iraq and we kill several hundred thousand people over oil the last time, sorry, the 1991 invasion, we don't say that we were freeing Kuwait, you know, the democracy of Kuwait. We were freeing the democracy. But when we go into Somalia with the Black Hawk helicopters, we're not going there to take back the oil that the people have decided they're going to now own. We go in there to help feed the little children and keep them from the warlords that are there. Or when we go into Panama, we're not going there to kill people and kill 5,000 people that we actually killed under the helmsmanship of Colin Powell. We didn't go into Panama and just kill 5,000 people. We went there to arrest a drug dealer named Noriega, who also happened to be on the CIA payroll, but that's another conversation. So we know that crime is, in fact, a political question. It's not a moral question. It's a political decision made by those people who are in power to define what is and what isn't. So in order to talk about how did all of this happen and why is it happening today, and in the light of the resegregation of American schools and in the light of the end of affirmative action, and people saying, Well, we really are talking about the content of the character. Everybody should be on an equal playing field. What's the problem? Why are you still talking about slavery? Why are you still talking about your oppression? Martin died for your freedom. What's wrong with you? You know, it reminds me of, and I do tell this story often, but it reminds me when I lived in France for a while, and I was there in 1994 when a guy named Paul Touvier was put on trial for his activities with the Vichy government. Well, the Vichy government was that so-called entity that was invented by the Nazis and the collaborationist French to save France so that it wouldn't be totally occupied by the Germans, who had basically killed half of northern France and then were about to move and destroy the Louvre and everything else. And so the Vichy government theoretically was that government that said, okay, we'll work with the Germans. And what we'll do is just basically send a couple hundred thousand French Jews to the death camps. And that's what they did. And everybody kind of didn't want to talk about it because most of the French were going along with the Vichy government program and, you know, keeping their lives going. And what can we do? What else can we do? People, you know, said the French were thinking, we're not counting the rampant anti-Semitism in France. But in any case, and so when in 1994, the French government then found Paul Touvier, who was a high, high ranking member. And so they arrested Paul Touvier and put him on trial for war crimes, what have you, but specifically for seven people who were killed in a small village in the southern part of France. And the French were very upset about this. They said, look, we can't put this man on trial. The man is 80-some years old. He's damn near dead anyway. And why put him on trial? You know, this is over. The war's over. You know, we don't want to talk about the Vichy government anymore. Of course, the French don't want to talk about the Vichy government because it's a little embarrassing, you know. And so the French prosecutor said, you know, they said, look, you know, let's just move on. You know, the way we say here, get over it. It's over. Let's just move on. And so the French prosecutor says, yes, well, you know, we do have to turn the page of history and move on. But in order to turn that page, we have to write that page. So in order for us to move on in any dialogue here in America about why black people are in this situation, we have to know the history and we have to write the true history. And it can't be the history where the pilgrims sit down with the Indians and have Thanksgiving dinner. Because we still have those celebrations in little elementary schools. Little kids dress up and they put on little pilgrim clothes, put on little Indian clothes, they play Pocahontas and everything. Notwithstanding that Pocahontas is all her whole people, the Powhatan Confederacy, all 30 tribes were murdered for the state of Virginia to come into being. So notwithstanding that part of the history, the bloody part that we don't like to deal with, the blood that runs through every single part of this country, the blood of the indigenous people, let's just talk about the black people. The 250 years of slavery, because there was only one group of people in the slave class, and the slavery was a class because it was a labor class, right? It was a labor class. It was free labor. And there was only one group of people, those Africans, that were in that class. You had indentured servants, and you had a number of other things, and people like to argue the little nuances of difference, but the massive number of people for 250 years, millions of people born and died in slavery in the United States of America were there to do one thing, and that was to produce market products for the development of this so-called country, which was really just a business in the beginning, as it sort of remains. And so you have a situation where what's important about this is to understand that black people were never here for any other reason. We didn't come looking for religious freedom. We did not come, give me your tithe, you're poor. No, we didn't come to work in the industrial fields. We came here because we were snatched, and we did not come here voluntarily like the Vietnamese of today or the Koreans or anybody else that's coming here. We didn't come here like the Europeans at the turn of the 20th century. We came here as slaves to do one thing, be labor, a free labor pool. And we were identified, justified, our existence was justified that we were really not human beings. As a matter of fact, we were identified as chattel. And so we couldn't get married because, you know, when you talk about the breakdown of the black family, slavery was institutionalized, you couldn't get married and stuff. So, but I'm not going to talk about the pain of slavery, because that would be too big and too horrible. And we'd have to have a Holocaust museum, wouldn't we? But we don't have one of those in America. So we go through the pain of what 250 years of slavery was about. But what we can talk about is what did it mean in terms of the condition and status of black people today. And what it meant was effectively by by the 1776, when the country decided it was going to become a country, or that is to say, the gentleman who created a gentleman's agreement called the U.S. Constitution, all these people signed one document and said, we believe all men are created equal. At least those of us who signing this document, most of us who happen to be slaveholders, and all of us who are white and male. So that eliminated everybody that wasn't white, male, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, landholding, slaveholders, right? So everybody else really wasn't exactly included in that equation, but we imagined later on that we were. So we're gonna say that in 1776, all men are created equal, and we're not gonna pay the crown another dime for all this money we're making. Because by the turn of the century, by the 1800s, the United States, Georgia, for example, where I live, was producing all of the cotton, was the greatest cotton producer in the world. South Carolina, the greatest rice producer in the world. The country was, economy was blossoming and building up. And the northern states that were saying, well, we're not involved with slavery. Well, they were benefiting tremendously from the textile industry, from cotton and so forth and so on. Sugar, coffee, tobacco, what have you. All slave labor and slave intensive, by the way, and labor intensive. In 1776, we have the country forming itself, and in the Constitution, it was identified the slave population, each slave represented 3/5 of a man, right? Excuse me, 1800, when Thomas Jefferson runs for president, first against Aaron Burr, but really against Adams, and wins the presidency. How does he win the presidency? Through the so-called Electoral College. And we study this from the vantage point of the Electoral College, don't we? But we don't study this from the vantage point of the way that Thomas Jefferson really won the Electoral College vote was that he showed that he actually represented more constituents. And who were those constituents? Well, if you were 100 white men in Massachusetts and you didn't have any slaves and there was no slave population, but if you were 100 white men in Virginia and you had a slave population, well, you could count those 1,000 slaves as 3/5 of a man. So that gave you an advantage over the so-called free white men in the North. And that's how Thomas Jefferson won the election, But in the meantime, Thomas Jefferson said some other stuff that was pretty interesting because it lays down the culture that we see today. Thomas Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, another thing that people should be reading, because it's published all the time, it's not a secret book called The Notes. The only book Thomas Jefferson ever wrote was called The Notes on the State of Virginia. And in The Notes on the State of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson proposes that, or asserts rather, that when talking to the French, because he was a Francophile and he loved to talk to the French, and the French were saying things like, well, you have a country and you talk about all men are created equal, but, you know, you still have slavery. How do you put those two things together? You know, it's like sort of today, how do you have a country that's promoting freedom and democracy around the world with the largest prison population in the world? It's amazing, isn't it? Something wrong with that picture, too. So we get back to Thomas Jefferson saying, well, there's a reason why we can't bring the black into this society as an equal. And the reason is that there are these differences, and they're not just of social. They're biological. Look at the color of the black, he says. Is it the color of blood or bile? But it's certainly not as agreeable as the mixture of red and white among the white. And what about the black, the odor? The blacks have a disagreeable odor. He said they're lazy. They don't have any music in them or art in them. They have never written anything. They have no real history as a people. Even the natives, the Indians, can do better than the black. And he says, I would say, therefore, that the black is inferior to the white in both body and mind. Now, this is not me, you know, some conspiracy theorists from the 60s, you know. This is Thomas Jefferson. This is the man that everybody says is the greatest man, the greatest president, certainly one that Clinton thought was the greatest president, and almost everybody says the greatest lays down the foundation of this very country, the ideology of this country. And, of course, at the same time was one of the largest slaveholders of his time, notwithstanding that he owned some of his own children and the woman that had been the mother of those children, that was the mother of those children. Sally Hemings. But Jefferson puts this forward, and then we get Jackson talking about America as an Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. But all the while, the country is building up its wealth on the back of black slave labor. And then finally, we get Lincoln coming along, who says he's running on, people think that he's running for office on a slave thing, but really Lincoln is talking about the change and bringing in more white people and having an industrial country and understanding there's a shift now going from an agrarian society to an industrial-based society because of steam engine things are coming in and people are beginning to realize that there has to be some kind of new economic base. But in any case, Lincoln, of course, the war breaks out in 1861, and Lincoln gets involved in the war, and everybody's very upset. And, you know, it's 1863, he issues the Emancipation Proclamation and says, well, I'm freeing all the slaves in the seceding states. And that's an interesting proposition because Lincoln was not the president of the seceding states. They had a president. He was president of the Confederacy, was Jefferson Davis, of course. So Lincoln had no power over freeing anybody, but the slaves thought that they were being freed, and many of them just stopped being slaves and ran away and tried to join the Union Army, which, of course, Lincoln told them they couldn't join. But in any case, people fought. The war, the tide of war was changed in 1863. 1865, of course, we have the end of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery under the 13th Amendment. But just before the 13th Amendment is ratified, what happens? We have the institution of the black codes in the South, where the majority of black people still lived as former slaves only 10 minutes ago. And we have the rise of white terrorist organizations and the Ku Klux Klan and so forth. So here are these black people that yesterday were slaves, and now they are not slaves. But there is this other little detail about the black codes. And the black codes defined the behavior of blacks. It governed the behavior of blacks in particular. And the black codes said that, you know, black men couldn't walk down the street and they had to move out of the way when a white man came down the street or something like this. But the most difficult thing that the black codes did was to govern whether or not you were a criminal. And that criminal behavior could be defined in a most difficult way if you were a vagrant. That is to say, if you didn't have a job. Now, here you were a slave a minute ago, and now somebody's talking about you don't have a job. Well, what job could you possibly have? Well, the job you will have in about 1 minute is that I will now declare you a criminal because you're a vagrant, and I'm going to put you in jail, and I'm going to put you in prison, and you'll work on the chain gang, you know, and build all the railroads and the things that black people did during that period. And so black people fought, and so many people went back to sharecropping, which was sort of pseudo-slavery, and looking for 40 acres that had been promised by men like Thaddeus Stevens and the Freedmen's Bureau and of course, General Sherman's order number 15, field order number 15, when he won the war, he said, we're going to give all these confiscated lands back to, or give some of this land to these slave families. And so, and in fact did that, tried to do that. And of course, that was soundly rejected, and blacks never did have 40 acres. Many of us still walking around here looking for of 40 acres as we speak. And so there's this period when we're not clear what our relationship is to America, but we know one thing. We don't have any place to live. We don't have any food. We don't have any anything, but we're just not slaves. And that's really all the 13th Amendment did. And, of course, you had the 14th and 15th Amendments talking about equal protection on the law and so forth, none of which really mattered when you considered the vicious behavior of groups like the Ku Klux Klan and the Whites of the Night Camellia and the Knights of the White Camellia and so forth. And by 1895, of course, we have this great speech by Booker T. Washington saying, look, you know, we're not going to make it here, but we're not going to try to, we don't want to mess with your society. We don't want to come in there. We're not going to bother your women, but we've got to have some place to live. We need some money. And we have to have some kind of economic base for ourselves. And so Washington gets money from them. And of course, then around the same time, we had a guy named Homer Plessy in Louisiana. You know, Homer Plessy was an octoroon. He wasn't exactly black. He was called an octoroon, one-eighth black, whatever that means exactly. Nobody's sure, but, you know, one mother, father, whatever. One-eighth black. And Plessy was sitting on a train in Louisiana in the white section and just sitting there like this. I'm white. I belong here. But there was a black section. It wasn't as nice. And so finally, Plessy was put off the train, told that he was black, and he had to sit back with the black people, and Plessy sued. And his first argument was that he wasn't really black anyway. Pardon me. How could we define him as black? He wasn't really that black. He was more white than he was black, so he should be considered white and be able to sit. So his argument wasn't segregation. His argument was whether or not a black person was really a black person who was as white as he was. And the court said, Plessy, you're black. So let's go to your next argument, because you are going to be black here. In America, you're black. So Plessy said, well, all right, but even if I am black, then I'm a citizen, and I have a right to sit on that train. I paid the same money as everybody else. I have a right to sit in the same car with those people. And they said, look, you have no citizenship right when it comes to private affairs. This is a private affair. This is a train company. This is not a citizenship right. This is not voting. This is social interaction. We can't force white people to like you. As long as there are equal accommodations, we agree with the Louisiana, we uphold the Louisiana law, they can be separate. So we get the doctrine of separate but equal, but which is, of course, American apartheid. And so now black people have to figure out how to get around the Ku Klux Klan, how to live without the 40 acres, how to get around the black codes and not be criminalized for every little thing, and also how to get around American apartheid. It's a rough time at this turn of the century. There was no freedom, though. That's the one thing we do now. So we had people like Du Bois talking about, look, you know, we've got to improve ourselves. We've got to integrate. The beginning of the NAACP, we've got to integrate. We have Garvey, Marcus Garvey, saying, look, we've got to develop our own economy, develop our own businesses, and in matter of fact, just leave. You know, we have to we just leave America. It's clear they don't want us here. Get up some money, get together, and go back home to Africa. And, of course, even that wasn't enough because Garvey was taken down by little J. Edgar Hoover, who would be popping his head up ignominiously throughout the rest of history with black people until the day he died in 1972. So Garvey was accused of mail fraud or something, went to prison, and eventually was deported back to Jamaica. And that the UNIA was more or less crushed. But there were people who were fighting against lynching. And there were people, because there were a lot of anti-lynching movements going up because there was so much lynching of blacks going on. And there were people who were fighting to get jobs and say that we're not going to shop where we can't work and so forth and so on. And then you had all kinds of other movements, all kinds of other things that were going on. People were trying to just get basic things, housing, health care, food, employment, just basic things. Nothing, you know, as exotic as freedom of the press, because you couldn't really eat the press, you know what I'm saying? Nothing as exotic as freedom of speech, but things like food and clothing and housing and health care and things that you needed as a human being. And, of course, at one point, finally, we had little Linda Brown's father saying, look, education is something else I need. But my daughter can't get a good education. Plus, she's walking 4 miles down the road, little Linda Brown's father said, in Topeka, Kansas, and I want her to go to that better school right there, that we don't have equal accommodations down the road. And the court in Brown said what? Said, you're right. Separate is not equal as to public education in America, so we overturned Plessy on that question, not on every question, but at least on public education, and we say that we call for the desegregation of public schools in America, right? Has there ever been a more bloody moment when the court in Brown said, we want the desegregation, and the following rulings from the Supreme Court that ultimately called for the desegregation of public schools? White people went crazy in America. Little black children trying to get on a bus, four little children, 18,000 crazy people coming out, spitting on them, throwing rocks at them, turning over buses in Boston, spitting on people in Alabama, what have you. Little Arthurine Lucy, remember the great Norman Rockwell painting where you have little Arthurine Lucy, her mama has pressed her hair and put her so pretty, she got a little dress on that her mother ironed, and she's being spit upon so bad that you got to wring the spit out of her dress. And when you tell me that black people don't care about education, it really shocks me because people have forgotten about Brown and how hard we fought just to sit down in a classroom. And even that was challenged every single day. Until now, it's so challenged that it doesn't exist. We're back to the segregation of public schools. And the only reason that's important is the same reason it was important for Plessy. It's one thing to say that you have to be in a segregated car. But it's another thing when if you don't own the car, and I define what you sit in, and you don't get to sit anywhere at all. And so we had the same thing in 1955 with Rosa Parks doing what Plessy did. What did she say? She said, I paid the same price. I'm not going to stand up. I'm going to sit where I want to sit like everybody else. Trying to get on the bus in 1955, not get 40 acres, not get education, just a place on the bus if I have the money to pay. So we're already in the middle of the last century, and black people haven't even begun to talk about freedom. But we did begin to talk about freedom. We had the great voice of Martin Luther King coming out of the Birmingham bus strike. And we had Martin Luther King talking about these are the freedom rides. We're going to ride for freedom. We're going to get our vote back in the South. And you had wonderful people like Fannie Lou Hamer and, you know, all of these other great civil rights activists and people from SNCC and all the other organizations saying we want to eat where we want to. We want to have access to public accommodations. You know, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee started to desegregate really the Woolworths in the South, which is, you know, we'll just put that in parentheses and say, okay, whatever. Even if it was Woolworths, we understand the point, you know. But it is hard to imagine that you would fight for the right to eat at Woolworths, but nevertheless they did. and got killed for trying to fight for the right to eating in World War II. Oh, irony of ironies. But so now you're in 1955, 1956, in the 60s, and so you get to a point where Black people are, you know, all those great images that we've seen on television, and that's why we know things were bad, because we saw those images televised by this new thing that had come out of World War II, mass communication through television. And people all over the world were saying, wait a minute, this is the land of the free? Look at these people being hosed down, trying to go sit at a lunch counter, trying to vote. Are you kidding? America got embarrassed. So people started talking, and by that time, Kennedy was even talking to King. And King marched on Washington, made those great statements. And by that time, Kennedy is killed, and then we have Johnson saying, look, I'm going to give you some poverty money, and I'm going to give you the civil rights legislation, 64, 65, and you go off and do your thing, because I'm getting ready to invade the Gulf of Tonkin and kill some Vietnamese, because these people are going to the communists, and we can't afford that, because we have to control the entire world. We're a democracy. We're not capitalists. The communists are communists, but we're not capitalists. We're seeking democracy in Vietnam. And so we're already in 1965, and so there's an arc now of 100 years, right, from 1865, from the abolition of slavery to 1965, and so we find that Black people can now get on the bus, use a public toilet, drink out of a public fountain, go to Woolworths if you have the money, and that's it. That's the whole piece. No land, no 40 acres, no housing, education, all that other stuff. That's still, we're talking about discrimination, redlining, all those things that we now know about. And so the Black Panther Party was founded in 1966. And we said that, look, America has not provided a place for us. We are not free in America. We are Black people in America, but we're not free in America. And what does freedom mean? Well, it means something more than just so-called civil rights. It means human rights. It means that if somebody tells you that you can't get any kind of health care or treatment, like Dr. Charles Drew, who invented, came up with the blood plasma and so forth, died, end up not being able to have access to. If you can't get that because you don't have access to it, not only because of discrimination, but because of money, well, there's a price on your head. You know, if you need to eat every day, and you have to pay to eat and you don't have any money, you're probably going to die. So there's a price on your head. And so we said that everybody had a right to these basic things, and particularly Black people, and that we were seeking our total liberation in America, our total liberation. And that meant that we wanted to control our destinies and own the things that affected us and have some input as to how we would behave. And we wanted something more than our civil rights. And so we wrote a 10-point platform and program, and Bobby Seale and Huey Newton and all these other people in Oakland, California stood up and said, look, the first thing we're going to do is I'm going to talk about the brutality. We want an end to police brutality of our people. Can you imagine in 1966, and we're still talking about these issues today? Talking about the murder of not just of Rodney King, but all the other people get murdered in the streets of America by, you know, Amadou Diallo, so forth and so on. Still talking about police brutality. And so Bobby and Huey talked about the police brutality, and they said, look, we're going to make an example. We're going to show the people that we have a right to defend ourselves against this kind of brutality. Started carrying shotguns. And, of course, we were identified as the terrorists of America. J. Edgar Hoover identified us as the greatest threat to the internal security and developed many, many programs to murder us and destroy us in whatever way is possible. But in the meantime, we began to realize that our freedom was important to us. That was our central theme, the freedom of Black people in America, the liberation of Black people. We wanted land. We wanted clothing. We wanted housing. We wanted health care. We wanted food. We wanted justice. We wanted peace. And we wanted to control our destinies. That's what we thought freedom was. And we said, but how can we talk about our freedom in the face of the Chicanos in this country, and particularly in the state of California where we were, where we started, who are picking all the food and being exploited like slaves themselves? How can we talk about our freedom when all these Latinos and Chicanos are walking around here exploited like slaves themselves? We said we can't, so we helped to formed a coalition with the Brown Berets. And what about the indigenous people? Did we forget about them? Locked on reservations, almost murdered in mass. We helped to form American Indian Movement and formed a coalition, therefore, with the American Indian Movement. Yes, the terrible cases going on in North Dakota, but we could talk about that another time. We said, what about the Puerto Rican, poor Puerto Rican, working the industrial fields of New York? We formed a coalition, helped to form the Young Lords. What about poor whites in Appalachia? Don't have any running water, can't eat, living just like we are, just don't know it. especially those that had moved from the South, migrating to the North the way black people had. So we helped to formed a coalition with the Patriot Party out of Chicago. Chinese formed a coalition with the Red Guard. What about women? Half the population is oppressed. We were the only black organization to say that women's liberation was a part of our struggle for liberation. What about gays? We said we were the only black organization, the only progressive organization to talk about gay liberation was a part of the liberation struggle of black people. What about people who were handicapped and locked in wheelchairs and locked in their bodies? We said the liberation of handicapped people is a part, so we helped to form a coalition with the Center for Independent Living. What about the fact that the whole country is polluted? How can we talk about our freedom when we're living in all of these polluted environments? And so we formed a relationship and a coalition with the Trust for Public Land and started developing gardens in the ghetto. And then we talked about, of course, the Vietnamese. How can we talk about the freedom of black people when this country is murdering the Vietnamese people, as the king himself said? I can't tell you not to fight against America when America will kill people in Vietnam. And so we opposed the Vietnam War. We were one of the only black organizations to oppose the Vietnam War, with the exception of King himself, who was actually denounced by half the other black people that he was surrounded by for that opposition. Not only did we oppose the war, not only did we call for peace, but we called for victory for the Vietnamese. We said, how can we talk about our freedom when blacks in South Africa are not free? So we talked about we formed a coalition with the PAC. What about Mozambique, Frelimo, fighting for the liberation of Mozambique? What about Zimbabwe, ZANU, fighting for the liberation of the people of Zimbabwe? What about the people in South America? And what about the people in Asia and other parts of the world? We said that, wait a minute, our freedom is interconnected to the freedom of all people. And so our agenda became the end of all forms of oppression and exploitation, and we became revolutionary internationalists. And so the Black Panther Party was, needless to say, targeted for this. Targeted so badly that ultimately we were pretty much destroyed from both within and without for a variety of reasons. But that at the end of that period, and you can't just mark it at the end of the death of Martin Luther King in 68, because we remember King, but we don't remember the dream, much less who slew the dreamer. We don't even think about what happened. Black people didn't become free in America. And why is it important even to talk about black history or black people? As King himself said, the destiny of black people is tied to the destiny of white people. You can't get around it, and you can't get over it, and you can't get under it. It is connected. So we will have to address this question, and we will have to write this page in order to turn this page. So where are we today? What has happened that would intervene to change the status of black people from the period of the Black Panther Party to today? Nothing. We have gone backwards. We have gone back to resegregation of schools. We hate to talk about affirmative action. We use the SAT as a slick way to say we want to keep out the poor and the blacks and other poor people. You know, people ask me, I'll say this very briefly. I had a kid ask me one time, but don't you think it's unfair? I'm a white guy, and my family works hard, and they're middle class. They're hardworking people, and I try to go into a college, and I have good grades, and I'm qualified, but there's a black kid who's less qualified than I am, but he gets in, and I don't. Don't you think that's unfair? And I know there's some people in this room thinking, it is unfair. And I said the same thing. It is unfair. It's unfair because—and so I said, your problem is you're poor. You're down here with me. That's why you're arguing with me about a slot in the school. You're down here begging for a crumb with me. If you had any money, you wouldn't be here with me. So you have to realize we have common ground. The real issue, what's unfair, is not that that kid got the position over you, but why weren't there two positions? What's unfair is that everybody doesn't have access to higher education. So the thing about what has happened today that we have to look at historically is to understand that no intervening issues, no intervening factors have come into play to change the nature of, and the status of black people. Much as we fought, and there's never been any benevolence on the part of whites, even though people think that there has been. So see, people think affirmative action was some benevolent gesture on the part of whites. The bottom line is every single step that we've taken, blood has been shed. And we're still here. We're still talking about little B. We're still talking about 2 million people in prison, half of them black. We're still talking about black people dying of breast cancer and cervical cancer and the infant mortality rate and the wealth rate, which doesn't exist. There is no black wealth. There are some black people making a lot of money, but in terms of ownership of anything significant. So in closing, I want to say this. that if we want to talk about black history, we want to talk about what happened in the back in the day when I was in the Black Panther Party and what the role of women is, then let's get back to what is going on today. Let's not try to whitewash that and say that was all nice back then and let's review that history, but everything's okay today. It is not okay today. In many ways, it's worse for blacks in America than it was in 1966 when the Black Panther Party was founded. So I want to close with this concept. I want us to remember what Dr. King himself said, not what the Black Panther Party said, because people like Dr. King, he's more palatable, or at least he's been made more palatable. But the real Dr. King, what was he doing when he was killed? People say, oh, he was involved in a garbage strike, but that was on the side. He was headed toward Washington, D.C. in a poor people's campaign. And what was he talking about? He was talking about a dream of what? Of freedom, where everybody would have a guaranteed income. He talked about redistribution of wealth, guaranteed health care. And so when we look at who Dr. King became, at the end, then we have to understand who he was. And one of the things that he said, and that I think is important today, is he said, look at all that we have done, and yet the black is still at the bottom level of society. He said, what must we do to change this? He said it reminded him of a biblical story in which a juror came to Jesus and said, Jesus, I have committed so many sins. Do you think I can be saved? And Jesus said, Nicodemus, I don't think you can be saved. I think you're going to have to be born again. And so King said, using that parable, I'm looking at America and I'm looking at the status of black people and I'm looking at the destiny of all people in America as it's tied into the status of black people. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure America can be saved. I'm thinking it might have to be changed so deeply that it will have to be born again. It's got to be born again if it's ever going to live up to its creed. And that's what we have to know. If we want to live up to the creed, no matter how duplicitous, no matter how lying that creed was when it was uttered, if we want to do that, then we will have to talk about the kind of change and particular change in the status of black people so that, in fact, we will live up to the ideal that all men are created equal, endowed with the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thanks a lot.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.